question smashtions.
Well, thank you for downloading another podcast from us. Very nice people that we are. I'm Mark, he's Simon. This is Question Smashtions. It's also known as Coda Mayo's Take 3. Starting with this from someone who just signs the email H. Have either of you ever been courted by producers of the big three celebrity reality shows, I'm a Celebrity, Strictly Come Dancing, Four in a Bed, and in an inescapable theoretical circumstance where you must make a choice or dire calamity occurs, which reality show would you participate in? Personally, I would pay good money to see Mark eat a kangaroo's anus, says H.
Pardon?
That's what they do in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. That's that kind of thing.
Okay.
Have you not seen I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here?
No.
Haven't. Okay. Anton Deck.
No, yeah, I mean, I know, but isn't Nigel Farage in it at the moment?
He is. Whether he's still in it at the time of broadcast, who knows? So the deal is you have to be in I'm a Celebrity, Strictly Come Dancing, or Foreigner. I haven't seen Foreigner.
Okay, well, let's answer. No, I've never heard of it. Let's answer the first bit first. No, I have never been courted by any of those programs. Have you?
No, the only one I was courted by, there was a short-lived show. I can't remember what it was called, and it was filmed in Highgate. I can't remember. And they asked me if I'd be interested.
A reality TV show.
The only one I've ever thought, oh, yeah, I could imagine doing that, was there was a short-lived, by which I mean I think one season, conducting reality show.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Might have been called Maestro.
Didn't Goldie win it?
Maybe there was more than one season, because that does sound familiar. Perkins is the one I'm thinking. I think Sue Perkins won.
Oh, okay. No, maybe I'm thinking of something else.
Maybe there was another.
But one. Yeah, maybe I'm wrong.
Okay. Answer the question, I don't know about Foreign Bed because I've never seen it.
No.
It sounds wrong.
What is it?
It's a show. So you could say you've got to be on one of these three.
Okay.
I'm a Celebrity, Strictly Come Dancing, or Four in a Bed. What are you going to go on?
I suppose Strictly Come Dancing because I can't dance and I'd be off it very quickly, therefore. I can't dance, but at least it's not going to involve eating a kangaroo's anus.
Well, what about your back? Would that survive?
Hang on. Voice in my head is saying... So the voice in my head said, if you go on I'm a Celebrity... And the minimum...
No, that's what they got. Nigel Farage was given 1.5 million, but they don't all get 1.5 million.
No, but yeah, but...
I don't think...
Okay, so can I... But just to say, for the record, it's just like, you know, this is never going to... For the record, I know. I mean, they've had Nigel Farage on that program. I absolutely cultural boycott, 100% evil. No, I'm sorry. It's vile. It's absolutely disgraceful. How dare they? How very dare they? So absolutely not that. I don't know what Four in a Bed is, but I don't like the sound of it. At least Strictly Come Dancing, it's just I'll just make an elephant of myself in public and that's not going to surprise anybody.
Also, I know Alan Dedicote, Craig Revel-Horwood.
That's the Strictly thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do that, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
I get booted off before you.
Yeah, and I hear, although I don't believe that I've met her, I hear that Claudia Winkleman is very, very nice all the guests. And, you know, so, that sounds perfectly fine. The idea of being stuck somewhere with a kangaroo's anus and Nigel Farage, or maybe that's the same
which
thing.
Which would you prefer?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Paul Madden, dear weary wassailers, I've recently developed the ability to listen to your witterings whilst driving. Before this, I could only listen when you were nestled in my ear with fruit-based pods and commuting in and out of London. Now I drive through deepest, darkest Kent, travelling through all my favourite Hursts, Sissing, Goode and Lamber. And being far behind, I push myself...
All my favourite Hursts.
And now, as if by magic, I can drive and pod simultaneously.
Excellent.
This email is in response to a recent, for me, feature around pieces of music that make us cry. Thanks, by the way, for recommending Miranda Lambert's The House That Built Me. It had the desired effect. I wanted to put forward movies that do this, but really shouldn't.
Okay.
And it being Christmas and all that, I'm going to discuss Last Christmas.
Okay.
I am a huge George Michael fan, but Last Christmas has fleeting mentions and music interludes, so it can't be that. However, every time I watch it, at the point where the big reveal happens, and a few minutes later, Emilia Clarke, who was on the show, begins to sing the titular song, I Am For Nothing, blubbering and crying. No mulled wine is consumed. I tested this theory last week. For clarification, my favourite movies this year have been Past Lives, Close and Anatomy of a Fall. I can't explain it, but there is some piece of magic in Last Christmas which, let's be honest, was never going to get Oscars or a Kermode Award, and I don't know what it is. Are there movies that do this for either of you? What's interesting is, the reason I always mention Finlandia is I have no idea why it's an emotional piece
why
for
it gets
me.
You.
So Paul loves George Michael. I mean, it's a terrible film.
Is it terrible?
I do think it is. I remember going to see it because I was interviewing Amelia, and who was absolutely delightful.
It's co-written by Emma Thompson, and Greg Wise wrote the story.
Halfway through, I thought, Last Christmas. Go, that sure, it's not going to be. Oh, it is. And just thinking, oh, really? Anyway. So I don't know what it is, Paul, but isn't that nice that there's some magic somewhere, which means that it can turn on the waterworks for no apparent reason.
I mean, I would say the same thing about, Love Actually, we've gone on about, at great length, that always works for me. Somebody wrote in an email here recently saying, Splash, isn't that just Tom Hanks and John Candy, perving over Daryl Hannah? No, it's not. It's really charming and really funny and really sweet.
Fiona Spears in Pickerington, Ohio. Okay. It's going to be a short answer from me and a long answer from you.
Okay.
Do either or both of you have a preferred seat or seating row when you watch films in the cinema?
Oh, for God's sake, yes.
So for me, no. Mark?
Yeah. Last aisle seat on the left. I have to do aisle seats. I can't do trapped seating. Don't do trapped seating. Would actually leave the cinema rather than do trapped seating.
When you say trapped seating, you mean just not being on the end?
Not being on an end.
It's not officially called trapped seating. It's just called seating.
I've always called it trapped seating. And it started because when I was a kid, I used to have this thing which was, I don't think this is a great revelation because I'm sure that many people have experienced the same thing. If I was going to the cinema, which I did all the time, and a film was going to be like 2 hours long, I'd have to time going to the loo beforehand, okay? Because, you don't want to go to the loo in the middle of the film because then you'll miss a bit of the film. And if you sit on an aisle seat, which means that you can go to the loo, you don't need to go to the loo. But if you sit in a middle seat, you immediately need to go to the loo.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So that was how that began. And then I've got a lazy left eye, so I would lead with my right eye, so I would always sit on the left aisle seat. And that just happened. And then with screening, and I also, in an ideal world, we've talked about this before, the seat in front, the seat beside, and the seat behind are completely empty. But yes, I'm very, very, very particular. I have a thing with every single screening room that I go to in London. Each different one has got the seat that is the seat that I need to sit in. And I have to get there early enough to be the very first person in to put my bag on that seat. Otherwise, I can't relax.
I told you it was a long answer.
And in the case of Universal Studios, when I go to Universal, Dave Norris has to actually put a bag on the seat that I sit in. And if he doesn't come in to work that week, he has to get somebody else to do it for me because otherwise I can't function.
Okay, there you go. There's people.
But you're fine anyway.
Yeah, pretty much, I would say. Not the front, I would, because then you get neck ache. but apart, your next memoir should be called Last Seat on the Left.
Last Aisle Seat on the Left, yeah.
That would work. But I think next seat on the left feels like last house on the left.
No, so. But that's the point. When I used to have it as my location on the thing, was my location is last aisle seat on the left. It was a joke about last house on the left.
Neeraj in Candolim, which, as you know, is in North Goa. What did you believe in for your entire childhood that was later proven to be false? So it's quite a difficult question because it's your entire childhood.
But what do you call your entire childhood?
Well, that's right. And also proven to be false.
Well,
so that's quite
can
strong.
I tell you immediately the first thing that comes into my mind? I'm sorry that things have taken this kind of turn.
Yes.
I believed when I was young that when you grew up, you didn't have to do poo anymore.
I thought that's good answer.
It was just something, and I figured this out because nobody grown up ever spent long enough in the loo to be doing a poo, and I really looked forward to the time when
such a thing wasn't
such
possible.
A thing was no longer necessary.
Wow.
And you know what? It turned out not to be true.
Okay, I'm not even going to give my answer because it's so it's too profound.
really?
Yeah. Well, no, you've just given the perfect answer because the key thing is you believe it in your childhood, proven to be false. That's exactly the right answer.
Okay.
Because it is demonstrably
not true,
provably false. I did Apparently, when I was a kid, I did. When I was in the at bath time, I used to pretend to be. I invented a creature.
Okay.
Called a shoot.
A shoot.
Yes, and I was a shoot with pretty bits. That's what apparently I used.
Did that then morph into Peter from Germany?
I think they were concurrent. out of the water, Peter from Germany, in the water, shoot the prince.
You're like a kaleidoscope of characters all living in the same body.
Most I think there's a word for that.
Demonic possession, isn't
yes.
it?
Thank you. Matt Woodhouse is next.
Okay.
Mark's answer regarding restoring faith in humanity reminded me of Christmas 2006.
Okay. My answer was... Your answer was to do with Israel Hamas and that,
yes.
the brilliant thing. That my answer was, because that was a big thing, the little thing was the existence of lost property offices.
Yours was a truer answer.
Because they demonstrate that somebody, for out of nothing but altruism, went to the trouble of picking up an object thinking somebody might want that back and taking it to lost property office.
So Christmas 2006, I was 32, had just moved to London, having separated from my then wife, and in a rare moment of the world not totally revolving around myself, thought I'd make an effort with
That's
my...
A great phrase.
With my family's Christmas presents. I bought my dad an MP3 player, worried that it would be far too high-tech for him. He's never off his iPhone now. I bought my mum her first mobile phone and a few other gifts that I'd put real effort into. This was most against my character. At the time, I worked on Berwick Street in Soho, which I believe is near lots of screening rooms.
Jeez.
And I often used to see Mark in the George Pub. I'd finished my shopping on Oxford Street, back from when there were non-sweet shops. And headed to...
Or, as we now like to call them, money laundering places.
That's right, that's Mark who said that. And headed to Charing Cross for the train back home. With half an hour to spare, I popped into the pub at the station. A couple of people had warned me against said establishment, saying it was a pickpocket's paradise and similar, but I always found it a perfectly reasonable place to kill half an hour. Next morning, having stuck to my two swift pints, I woke up and had a sudden realization that I couldn't remember where I put my shopping when I got in. Then I was full of dread and panic as I realized why. It was Friday morning. I trudged back through Charing Cross Station on my way to work. I thought I may as well see if the pub is open. The shutters were down, but I thought I'd give them a knock. To my surprise, someone answered, and I asked if anyone had handed in a couple of bags. To my complete astonishment, a wonderful person had handed in all of my Christmas shopping, and it was being kept safely behind the bar.
Well,
obviously, I never got round to saying thank you, but I'd like to now. Thank you. And love the show, Steve.
There we go.
Thank you, Matt. So that actually, all of that, and there's no question at the end of it.
Yeah.
No, but anyway,
that's brilliant.
But
that proves the point that a lost property office is one
yes,
of the small acts
does.
Of kindness that restores your faith in human.
Mark in Rotherham. For some time now, I've followed the developments of artificial intelligence with a disconcerting balance of worry, horror, and excitement. He raises so many questions, none of which seem to have coherent answers, but at the same time brings with it potentially endless possibilities. My question to you is, do you see the advance of AI as a positive thing for films and cinema, or deeply troubling? For example, if we could get to a point of a film starring a very true-to-life but long-deceased film star, would you want it to happen? A romantic comedy starring Marilyn Monroe and Jim Carrey, perhaps? Jim Carrey bit. Or a deep political thriller with Humphrey Bogart and Philip Seymour Hoffman. For me, the possibilities are both exciting and frightening in equal measure, but I'd be interested to get your take on it. I would say I would not be interested in that. I'm sure they'd be very clever and so on, but I don't... Philip Seymour Hoffman was a genius. I loved his movies, but I don't want to see him in anything else because he's no longer with us. And I mentioned this, I think, when it came up last time, because AI has come up quite a lot. When I heard Chris McQuarrie interviewed on the Script Notes podcast, he said the most interesting thing, I think, about AI in the movies, which is for script writers, it removes the possibility of being average. And he said, no one is great out of the traps. Everyone is average to start with, but QI. apologies
that
to child
volumes.
Three.
Yeah.
AI can do that now. It can do an average script now.
Yeah.
And he thought that was problematic. And that seems to be a very intelligent approach.
Yeah. I mean, I think that point that he raised was astonishing because I had never thought of it before. As far as the, you know, being able to revive dead actors, I have no interest in watching a computer-generated simulacrum of somebody whose work I liked, because the point is what I like about Philip Seymour Hoffman was Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's not that I want to see a thing that looks like Philip Seymour Hoffman and sounds like Philip Seymour Hoffman but isn't Philip Seymour Hoffman. I love the work that he did, and that's fine. However, I am slightly of the opinion that going, oh, AI, all bad, is not a great way to approach things, because as we have heard, there are applications. I mean, one of the things I do know about is that universities are now having to deal with AI possibly being used in essay submissions. And, you know, they have to detect whether or not something... There's two ways that it happens. One of them is that AI has this habit of doing... producing a phantom fact, or it goes with something which is completely wrong and out of context that you can spot, okay? But generally, the best way of spotting an AI-produced piece of work is by asking another AI to spot a piece of AI-produced work. The way in which deepfake technology worked, and I remember having this explained to me by somebody who was involved in visual effects, is that you have two separate AI generators, and one of them goes, okay, here is a picture of X, and the second one goes, okay, this is what's wrong with that picture. Here is a better version. And then the first one goes, okay, here is what's wrong with that picture that you just did. Here is a better version. And then and they do it like that, and they talk, and then they arrive at something in which neither of the two competing AIs can see that there's anything wrong with it, and that's the version that they produce. That, in a way, seems to me to be completely analogous to AI in general. It is neither one thing nor the other. It is whatever anyone you chooses to do with it. And I'm worried that us all going, it's dangerous and terrifying, which I've been part of as well, is not fully embracing that, well, it can be dangerous and terrifying, but it can also be brilliant and liberating. That said, I do not want to see it revive Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Here is a question from Patrick. It's a question, actually, I remember asking Richard Dawkins.
Okay. So it's... Wow.
The question is this, and it's a great question. What do you have zero evidence for, but are convinced is true?
Ooh.
So, I mean, this is, again, it's one of those questions which you can goes around the dinner table if you've got nothing else to discuss.
What did Richard?
Well, it was the only question that I gave Richard Dawkins, which he kind of went, oh, that's interesting. You know, all the other questions he just batted away because he'd been asked them before. Hmm. And I seem to remember he talked about his wife and the love of his wife, but then he realized that that wasn't true because obviously there is evidence to suggest that she might indeed quite like him.
Because she's still there and
yes.
Sticking by. Yeah, fine.
So it's an interesting... So,
okay.
So it's zero evidence, but you're convinced it's true. So,
gosh, that's very hard.
The first thing I wrote down was, I believe that when you get into a lift, the buttons that say doors close, they don't do anything. They're not wired to anything. That the lift open buttons, do they work? They might do. But when you press the shut the door button, it never shuts, ever. So I think, but I have no evidence.
So do you genuinely think that they're just...
That's how they do.
Okay, fine. That's interesting. Well, I'm sure there's somebody listening who works in a lift company
who can tell us,
because that is, I understand the thing, yeah. And then after that, you came up with?
Non-fungible tokens.
I don't know.
NFTs.
I
don't believe anyone actually used them, that they were just talked about. I mean... But
I don't really understand what it is.
So there you go. Apparently, this is called in philosophy an argument from ignorance, which we encounter an awful lot. Obviously, someone who's got a particular view, they've got no knowledge about the subject, but they're convinced that their argument is correct.
Yeah. But when you say you don't believe in what do you absolutely believe but have no evidence for about non-fungible tokens?
This is all going to break down very quickly.
Okay.
But because it's very Hobbesian, because I don't know anyone who has any interest in non-fungible tokens, I kind of assume that no one really has any interest in non-fungible tokens.
But didn't idiot Trump make millions by selling a non-fungible token playing cards of himself dressed as an astronaut?
Yeah.
I read about that in
the
paper.
Now you argue it that way. Maybe I should have invested in that. I should. In fact, I'm going to get you one of those for Christmas.
Yeah, great. Because you know, but I mean, I don't understand what honestly, I don't know what fungible means.
Okay, how about this? I don't think there's any intelligent life out there in space.
Oh, okay. Do you not?
I don't really know.
Okay, Fine. In that case...
But absolutely no evidence.
Right. I would say I do believe that there is intelligent life out there in space, and I have absolutely no evidence for that.
So there we go.
That's interesting. You believe one thing, and I believe another thing, and we have no evidence on either side for either of those two things.
Okay, how about, whilst we're there, how about this? We were not the first universe. So that before the Big Bang...
Right.
I did ask Jim Al-Khalili this once.
And now you're asking me. Wow.
No, well,
that's a declining career.
Throwing it out there that the Big Bang came from some. So before the Big Bang, there was something. There was another universe which exploded or something like that. So this universe came from another universe.
Okay. My answer to that will be I have no idea. I don't have a belief or anything. No. I just have no idea at all because I've always found it very hard to get my head around the concept of, you know, everything begins with the Big Bang and you go, yes, okay, but what's before that? No, time doesn't exist before that. Okay, so what, you know, but I don't know what to believe about it because also my father used to love books about space and relativity and all that kind of stuff. And he loved explaining the thing about the universe is expanding, revolving.
Into what?
Exactly. But so the answer is I don't know. My tiny brain can't get my tiny brain around
the
new, it.
The latest episode of Doctor Who goes to the very end of the universe. And
is there a restaurant there?
No, there isn't a restaurant, but...
You got that?
Yes, absolutely, of course. The Douglas Adams reference. But the Doctor is trying to explain the maths behind being at the edge of the universe and what... What comes up next?
Yeah.
So Doctor Who, if you see David Tennant, ask him, because apparently there's some mathematics, which is obviously just made up by Russell T.
Okay. Have you seen the new Doctor Who thing?
I've seen the second one, yes.
Is it good?
Yeah, it was good. Great. Yeah, it was good.
Okay. And is that explanation in there?
No. It's a gag, really.
Yeah, okay.
Fine. They've made up a type of maths which doesn't actually exist.
Well, that's, again, that's Douglas Adams, which is bistro maths. Remember that? Bistro maths is a way of doing maths, and it's based on the thing that if you go to a bistro, the numbers written on a thing by waiters bear absolutely no relationship to the dishes that were had or the number of people at the
table.
Bistro maths.
This is from Matthew. We've got two more before we're done. Matthew Kershaw, Bronze Duke of Edinburgh Swimming Award. Since it's now officially rom-com season, Daughter One was watching The Holiday this week, starring Kate Winslet, Jude Law, Cameron Diaz and Jack Black. Now, it's my firm belief that as great an actor as he may be and as talented and likable as he definitely is, Jack Black should not be in rom-coms. It's just wrong. So my question is, what actors do you think should not be in rom-coms?
Tom Hardy.
Yes, I think that's good. Also, I would add Steven Seagal.
Yeah, he shouldn't be in films.
You interviewed him once. I did on
Five
Live.
He was an arse, right?
It was a live interview and he was an arse.
An arse.
He was absolutely unbearable and I should just have stopped. And the other I would suggest Jared Leto.
Yeah, that's good.
But then I realised that I don't particularly just want to see Jared Leto in anything. So maybe
there's a very good bit at the beginning of Brian Cox's autobiography in which he describes a conversation with Steven Seagal, and it is the most withering description of a human being you have ever read. It's quite wonderful.
Oh, I should look that up.
Yeah,
this was an album that he'd made.
Yes, you know, that's right.
Country songs or something. Terrible.
Yeah, because Steven Seagal sings country and western hits is something that everyone needs in their life.
Ali in Leighton, dear subtitled version of a foreign language film and dubbed version. Why do I always get the sense that watching a dubbed version of a foreign language film is slightly looked down on in comparison to watching a subtitled version? Film is a visual medium, and I always feel like I'm missing so much that's going on in the frame by having my eye constantly drawn to the bottom of the screen. In that sense, I really do find subtitles to be a one-inch barrier in that they prevent me seeing what the director intended. Mm. Which is an interesting point. And actually, you definitely do miss some of the acting and the action if you are reading like two lines which have come up on the screen.
Yes. I think the answer is that I would say that I'm not conscious of reading subtitles, but then I've done it a lot. I have done it a lot because I've been privileged to be in a position when I've been in film festivals in which you have subtitles going on the bottom, subtitles going up the side, subtitles, you know, surtitles, supertitles, undertitles. So I don't notice it anymore. The issue with dubbing is that if you take an actor's voice and replace it with the voice of another actor in a different language, it changes the performance. So whereas if you're watching a subtitled film and you are reading the subtitles, having a translation of the voice that is the voice of the film is preferable to the voice of the film being replaced by another voice. That said, there are, of course, famous cases in which the subtitle version, in which the dubbed versions are considered to be superior. And the classic one is that the dubbed version of Look Who's Talking in Italian is one of the characters. I think the Bruce Willis voiceover character is dubbed by Roberto Benigni, who just freestyles. And it's apparently the Italian version of Look Who's Talking is absolutely hilarious. And then if you look at Night on Earth, the Jim Jarmusch film, referred to Jim Jarmusch, who we were talking about earlier on in the program, the Night on Earth sequence with Roberto Benigni in the taxi, apparently the subtitles are doing like one third of what he does, because he's doing the Roberto Benigni stream of consciousness stuff. And if you put everything that he says on the screen, right, you wouldn't be able to see the screen. So the solution there is, the only way of really appreciating that performance is to learn Italian.
Yeah. From what I understand, one of the things AI is delivering is the fact that if you are the voice of an animated character, it will just, if you are Jason Isaacs and you've done a voice for an animator, it will still be your voice in French and your voice in Spanish.
Who was it that somebody was talking about this just recently, said, yes, if you could, the AI is working towards a language translation thing, which it does. But I have no idea what that would be like. Let's wait and see.
And of course, as Child One has explained to me many times, the main advantage of subtitles is that if you're eating crisps, you can still hear the dialogue.
And you know, loads and loads of people watch television and film with the closed caption titles on, because they find it clarifies.
Including me.
Yeah, well, including some of my children.
Yeah. Also because you can't hear sometimes. And if it's got strong New York accents or something like that, it helps. Also, it tells
or if it's
you,
Jared Leto and you can't understand what
tells
he's
you
saying.
What the music's playing in the
it
background.
It does, yeah, that's right.
Or if there's murmured conversation, it tells you either murmured conversation or it tells you precisely what you're missing. So then
a relative of a friend of mine got really annoyed with the news on their television. And they couldn't understand why the television kept explaining man walks over to the door and opens the door and the sun shines in. And it's because they had on the function, which was the explanation.
Oh, right. Okay, yes.
But they didn't know. And they'd had this on their television for about 6 months. And they thought that all drama had become overly expository.
If you have a question for us, just chuck it our way. You just send us an email to correspondence@kirbydemayo.com. And if you could keep them short, that's a lovely thing. We'll see you for take one and take two with you on Friday.